Welcome to the Anxiety Summit Season 2. This is Trudy Scott, your host. I'm a food mood expert, certified nutritionist, and author of the Anti-Anxiety Food Solution. And today our topic is called Deconstructing Medical Anxiety and Evidence-Based Natural Solutions for Anxiety. And our guest expert today is Saya G. A very big welcome to you, Saya.
It's a great honor to be part of your summit, Trudy. Thank you for having me.
Well, thanks for being here. It was nice that I first heard you present at the National Association of Nutrition Professionals Conference. It was a great conference and a great presentation, and we met briefly, and I love your site, Green Med Info, and your newsletter is fabulous, so I'm really pleased to have you here.
Oh, thank you. It was great meeting you in person as well. It was a great conference.
It was. Let me read your bio, and then we'll go right into this topic because it's a good one. Saya G is a widely recognized researcher, author, and lecturer, steering committee member of the Global GMO-Free Coalition, GGFC, an advisory board member of the National Health Federation, and the founder of the world's most widely referenced evidence-based natural health resource of its kind. He founded greenmedinfo.com in 2008 in order to provide the world an open-access, evidence-based resource supporting natural and integrative modalities. And I am such a research nerd. I absolutely love your website and all the resources that you provide. And as I said earlier, I'm just really thrilled to have you here because I know you're going to share some great evidence-based information and resources today.
Oh, thank you.
So let's go into our first question, which is, you say that modern medical screening and interventions are based on an outdated evidence base. And how do we overcome the fear and the anxiety through a radical change in health perspectives?
Thank you for asking. Yes, what I've identified to be one of the primary causes, what I would describe as a generalized anxiety that we all participate in, whether we know it or not, in relation to conventional medicine, is this concept that, you know, cancer is almost like an infection. You know, you get it like a bug, and it's a matter of trying to catch it early through diagnostic screening procedures such as mammography and prostate screenings. And all you can really do within this viewpoint is to pretty much wait till it occurs in your body, and then if you can get it early, you know, cut it out or print it out or medicate it out. And so what's happened in the past just 10 to 20 years is that the concept that cancer is just sort of a chaotic process that, you know, is like a genetic time bomb we inherit from our predecessors, you know, bad genes, so to speak, that just go off in our body, has been completely disproved. And what we're seeing now is that the National Cancer Institute itself commissioned an expert panel that they published their findings last year in the New England Journal of Medicine, and they discovered that, in fact, this is not the case, and that cancer is being overdiagnosed when, in fact, a lot of the growths that they're seeing with this technology are inherently benign. In fact, some argue that the definitions that we use today to describe, say, breast cancer, specifically ductal carcinoma in situ and a number of invasive cancers, should completely be reclassified to benign growths of epithelial origin. And the same goes for prostate cancer, which, as you may know, PSA screenings are no longer being recommended because what's happened is the statistics show that despite a huge increase in, you know, early-stage prostate cancers, what are called high-grade prostatic interepithelial neoplasias, they didn't actually see a reduction in prostate cancer mortality. And the same has been found now for 25 years of mammography. So all the fear that has been put into the public, creating anxiety, which is a lot of well-known physiological effects that are dangerous, for example, fight-or-flight type reactions where you have increases in cortisol, blood sugar, downregulation of the immune response, and adrenaline secretion, which has actually been shown to encourage the growth of treatment-resistant cancer in the body, is that people have been sort of mesmerized and, in a way, a spell has been put on them for many years, thinking that there's nothing they can do, that cancer's just this juggernaut based on the genes, having nothing to do with lifestyle choices or, you know, the way in which we approach life. And so all of that has changed. And unfortunately, when it comes to the front lines of practice, the standard of care, the physician, you know, telling people what they need to do to prevent cancer, this research has not filtered down. So one of the big advocacies we have at Greenman Info is, you know, educating people to the reality and that cancer is truly a adaptive response to highly unnatural conditions in our diet, our environment, and even, you know, chronic stress and anxiety, again, participate in the pathogenesis of these disorders. So that's something that if we can identify that we actually participate in the cause and we remove it or adjust that cause, then we take back control of our health. And so it's very empowering. And with that new perspective, anxiety tends to be backgrounded. It's not always present, like, oh my gosh, I need to get my mammography. I may not have a symptom of my body, but I know cancer could come up. And this whole sort of concept has really infected people with a lot of fear.
Very interesting. And I'm glad you mentioned the prostate cancer and the DCIS because you're right, it is being overdiagnosed. And we have, I just saw some recent research stating that I think very high percent of people with cancer have very high rates of anxiety. And I'm not surprised because there's this fear and this is unknown. And yet when you say, if we are empowered and we know that there are some lifestyle changes that we can make, some dietary changes that we can make, we can be in control of our health. And I love that you use the word empower because that's what we really want. We want to be empowered.
Yeah, absolutely, because the, you know, anxiety state is part of the human condition. I mean, it serves a function. It makes us hyper aware at times of what could be some harmful, you know, events in our future. But many of us feel this without any known cause, and it's just a general, almost bodily sensation, and that's what we really want to address here, hopefully, with some of these new studies that show that there are natural interventions, and there's also things that we take in our diets, medications, for example, that could be causing anxiety that we can also address by removing.
Great. Well, let's go into some of those. Let's start with some of the evidence-based natural interventions for anxiety.
Sure. You know, one thing that we've done is we've looked at the literature on Medline, because this is what our project is based on, of course, and there are 150,000 studies on the National Library of Medicine's database, Medline, which are in reference to anxiety. So, you know, we have a huge amount of literature that we can comb through and really get insight that is, you know, quote, evidence-based, you know, based on scientific research, which in today's, you know, climate, unless it's a published study telling you what something is or is not, many people, at least within the conventional medical community, don't think it's real. I don't believe that, of course. If I take a Bach flower remedy and I see a relief in anxiety, that's evidence for me and that's proof. You know, I don't need to, that's my N of one. I don't need a multi-million-dollar trial to prove that. Nonetheless, it is good to know there are these studies. And actually, when we look back at the time frame, in 74, for example, there were 1,000 studies a year being published on anxiety. Now it's 10,000 a year, which I think reflects in part just how profound a problem this is. Of course, you know, the chemical model using drugs, it has been very successful, and there are now billions of dollars being sold for drugs for anxiety. So what you can do is when you go on Medline, you can actually go through the filter for complementary and alternative medicine. And out of those 15,000 studies, 13,000 of them actually are specifically related to natural interventions. And what we've done at Greenman Info is look through a good portion of these and then index them on our anxiety research page. And we have 57 natural substances that are indexed. That may be a value for those who are looking for drug alternatives. So, you know, when we look at the research, kava is actually number one. And it's a very interesting plant because it's been used probably for thousands of years in Polynesia, you know, in the Pacific Ocean cultures like Hawaii for its tranquilizing properties. And we actually have 14 studies on Greenman Info just on kava's anxiety-reducing properties. And what's interesting, of course, Trudy, because your great appreciation for, you know, the evidence-based model, is the Cochrane Collaboration, which is considered to have the highest gravitas. They're independent relative to a lot of the scientific research that's pretty much just funded by Big Pharma. They try to, you know, look at all the research and sort of disentangle industry influence and bias. And they did a meta-analysis that found that it was definitely more effective than a placebo for treating social anxiety. So when you have that high-quality evidence saying that a natural substance can have value as opposed to a drug, it's very encouraging. Now, of course, there is a lot of concern over kava that has been blown really disproportionately out from the reality, which is that it's hepatotoxic, right, hurts the liver. And that is based in part on them using parts of the plant that weren't traditionally used. You know, the root is really the primary ingredient in these remedies. And if you take parts of the plants or prepare it in a way that's not traditional, you could end up bringing in some toxins. But when you look at it relative to, say, the liver-destroying properties of Tylenol, which I believe 50,000 people are harmed every year from Tylenol use, it's probably infinitesimal relative to just your basic, you know, NSAID drug. So kava would be pretty much top on the evidence list when it comes to a natural alternative for anxiety.
Okay, great. It's interesting that there's so much research on this, and I have been seeing this over the years. And interestingly enough, this is not one that I tend to use very much. And I think that you're right. There have been some concerns about the liver issues, and I'm glad you cleared that up, that it's the components that are used that is important. My concern with kava is I just think of kava as like, I think of it more like self-medicating with, like, when someone needs to use alcohol to relax, that they're self-medicating with it. And it's interesting that there is so much research on this one.
Yeah, this is a great point, Trudy. I should have qualified, because by no means would I want those listening to say, oh, well, we have a natural drug that we can now take to suppress the symptom, because really that's what's happening. You just sort of mimic the pharmaceutical one, and you assume that the root causes aren't really going to be addressed. And although kava, I think, could be kind of classified almost as a food intervention, I mean, it's something that you could put a little bit in tea. They mix it with chocolate. And certainly I believe in lower doses, in whole form, organically sourced, versus, you know, some type of caloric dose. So I think it is important. And later I hope to show that there's some things in the diet, for example, that can, you know, be a more direct way to intervene when it comes to anxiety. The second one that's really high on the list is lavender. And this is something that's been studied both as an aromatherapeutic agent, where you have these small molecules in the volatile fragrance that go right into the olfactory lobe and then start modulating all these different pathways in the brain. Now, there are many different ways of looking at this. There's actually research in the animal model specifically on it being serotonergic, meaning boosting the serotonin levels or preventing their turnover so they last longer. But the reality is there's so many other mechanisms that have been identified. For example, it inhibits what's known as a voltage-dependent calcium channel in a way similar to the drug pregabalin, also known as Lyrica. And then there's probably 10 or 20 other different ways in which it likely modulates traditional drug targets in the brain. And that's because the brain is so complex. We're dealing with hundreds of different biomolecules, many of them classified as neurotransmitters, that are, you know, making the magic of the chemistry of our brain produce, you know, emotions and feelings. So I don't imagine we'll ever fully understand how it works. But there is also research on an orally ingested form having a similar effects in reducing anxiety in patients. So the beauty of it is that it doesn't take much to, you know, dab a little bit of lavender on your wrist and just experience the aroma of it. It's even, you know, the flowers are even edible in small amounts. And there's ways that you can incorporate this into your life. It's also true that flowers themselves, I'm from Rutgers University. They did a clinical study there where they gave subjects flowers, and they had 100% positive results in their emotions, which I found fascinating. I mean, there should have been like at least one grumpy person there that wasn't excited to get flowers. But there's something probably evolutionary almost about our connection with flowers. And they're sort of the archetype of, you know, why did the universe produce something so intrinsically beautiful? Was it necessary to have these vibrant colors and beautiful forms? Maybe not. but there's something about flowers generally that I think help to support our emotions that won't ever really be reduced down in terms of explanation through physiochemical mechanisms. But I think it's important to acknowledge that the science says that, you know, lavender and other flowers are very helpful for anxiety. And that also includes bergamot and rose and orange oil. A lot of research has gone into identifying their benefits for anxiety states.
Wonderful. Just listening to you talk about the flowers, I'm sitting here smiling and thinking, oh, how beautiful it is to see some flowers in front of me. Just the thought of it makes me feel positive and happy. That's lovely. Thanks for sharing that.
You're a lovely person, I can tell.
Well, I love lavender. I think I've always been a fan of lavender, and I'm really pleased to see that there has been this research on oral lavender, and it is. I've seen good results with a lot of my clients, and I think it's great. You can put lavender, as you say, dabbed on your wrist, or you can put it in, sprinkle some in the, and have a nice warm bath, or put some by your pillow at night. It's really, really great. And put a big bouquet of flowers on your table, and maybe you'll feel happier too.
It's true. You know, they've done research in hospitals as well, where they just provided plants in the rooms. And it's been found that just simply the presence of plants has a positive effect on the recovery time and sense of well-being. So, you know, I guess it shouldn't be that mysterious to us that having something living from the plant world, you know, in our presence is a benefit to our spirit. But certainly the research now shows that that is true.
Yeah,
I'd also like,
And we see research on growing your, you know, growing vegetables and digging in the garden and how beneficial that is for mood too.
Oh, that's exactly true. In fact, the Japanese have a concept, I can't pronounce their term for it, but it's taking a walk in the forest, and it's a well-known therapeutic intervention that has been found to have profound benefits for health. You know, and that same is true if you take off your rubber shoes and put your feet on the ground and take advantage of this limitless stream of negative electrons that has antioxidant properties and helps to, you know, they call it grounding, try to neutralize some of the electromagnetic stress, that some of which is accumulated as charge in our body. So certainly reconnecting to nature is another way that we might address some of this hard to identify origin of anxiety. I think our cells are infinitely intelligent, you know, they don't lie. And because we're so immersed in such an unnatural environment, sitting in front of computers, I mean, I'm in an area where there's literally 20 different Wi-Fi connections right now that my, you know, wireless device can pick up. So I can only imagine how that makes our bodies feel. So sometimes it is just a matter of kind of reconnecting back to nature. I also want to point out with lavender, what's so interesting is that, you know, on our site, we have a section on each substance. There's about 1,600 index. And lavender, there's 37 different conditions that's been shown to be beneficial for. And most of these are psychiatric ones, from insomnia to depression to pain to dysmenorrhea, which is, you know, you're cramping during the menstrual cycle, aggression. And actually one of them, actually three studies, are on high cortisol. So one of the, you know, physiological markers for the fight or flight and anxiety is actually elevated cortisol, which does perform a very important function. It's an anti-inflammatory. If you're running away from a lion, or, you know, you've been attacked and your body's inflamed, cortisol is actually potentially life-saving. But when it comes down to you're feeling stressed and anxious sitting in your chair at work or driving your car, and you can't release those hormones into action through exercise, so to speak, it can be very harmful. So just the smell of lavender, and this is true for patchouli, what's so fascinating is that it was found to reduce blood adrenaline levels up to 40% within just an hour, just by smelling patchouli. So again, it's amazing what we can accomplish through very simple, beautiful, you know, fragrant interventions that have little to no harms associated with them.
Love it. And I love that you say little or no harm. That's what we're wanting.
Absolutely. We don't want that.
So we got a few more that we can talk about?
Yeah. You know, one of the more interesting ones is on probiotics, is that we don't realize this all the time, but, you know, our body is in many ways just sort of this fleshy envelope that bacteria carry themselves around with, because you have 10 times more bacterial cells in the human body. And something like, you know, 95% or more of the genetic information in our whole body is actually bacterial in origin. So, of course, there's something called the gut-brain axis, and that means that the brain and the health of the gut share in the responsibility for well-being. And so when your gut system that's dependent on these bacteria are out of whack, maybe you took an antibiotic or ate some food that had called in bad bacteria. A good example of this is wheat, because we've recently found a study came out showing there's over 75 different bacteria that will colonize the guts and grow when you eat gluten, because our body just doesn't have the ability to break down those really hard to digest proteins easily. You know, our enzyme capacity is very limited in this respect. So what happens is these not so good bacteria, including Clostridium botulinum, which can produce the most toxic substance on the planet, technically, that's natural, which is the botulin toxin that causes botulism, will potentially overgrow. So, our gut is so dependent on what we are or aren't eating, and when we're eating things that are upsetting the balance, it directly affects the health of our brain and our well-being. So there was a study that was performed where they showed that simply in animals that had chemically induced colitis, inflammation, the colon, they were anxious, very excitable. They gave them Bifidobacterium, which is a very well-known type of bacteria that is considered very beneficial, and they showed it reduced the excitability of the enteric or stomach neurons, which then affected the vagal nerve pathway, which goes right to the central nervous system. So, in other words, the bacteria can help to regulate and even, in some research, communicate to the brain. So it's a two-way street. And so in many ways, we now know that eliminating antibiotic exposure, staying away from genetically modified food, which has Roundup, which contains a chemical that actually inhibits the synthesis of certain essential amino acids, as you know, including serotonin. This is essential for keeping our anxiety at bay. And on the other side, eating a lot of raw vegetables or probiotically cultured vegetables, which contain just literally trillions of good bacteria that our body depends on. It's really been the cooking of food, the radiation, the microwaving of it that's created this really dead substrate for the bacterial colonies in our body. And so in order to get a reinfusion, you have to get good quality. When I say good quality, I don't just mean USDA organic. I mean vegetables that have been grown in healthy soil. And that's really where the root of our health comes from when it comes to probiotics. So, again, fascinating study. There is a connection between the bacteria in our gut and our anxiety state or our well-being state.
Great. And I'd like to get the links to these studies that we're talking about here, and I'll share them on the blog that goes with this interview. And I know we can grab them off your great website.
Absolutely. In fact, I've done a little review of this information, so I'll send you a link, and it'll give you all the links to the studies I'm referencing as well.
Okay. Excellent. Good.
Cool. So, what's interesting, too, I think people need to really acknowledge that, again, we don't want to reiterate, we don't want to focus too much on let's just take something to suppress this naturally. And so there's some causes to anxiety that many Americans are not aware of. And one of the more interesting ones is statin drugs, because this is a category that is being given to the public, in my opinion, unnecessarily, because, cholesterol is essential for cardiovascular health. It's actually part of the healing response. And when you have injured arteries, for example, cholesterol is used to help heal up those spots. Now, it's not that the Band-Aid cholesterol could be blamed for causing the injury, but that's what statin drugs are based on, that paradigm of, well, cholesterol causes the heart problems. And so what they're doing is they're taking a drug which is suppressing the production of cholesterol and other essential biomolecules like coenzyme Q10. And what it's doing is affecting the lipid composition of the entire human body. And cholesterol is so important to the brain specifically because it's a good portion of the dry weight of the human brain. I believe it's been estimated to be about 20-30% by weight of our brain is cholesterol. So when you suppress its production, you're actually really causing a breakdown of the very structure and therefore function of the human brain. And so research has been performed. This is post-marketing surveillance research where they basically, you know, put these drugs out in the market, millions of people take them, and they start to see signals, you know, years if not decades later, wow, they're starting to experience increased anxiety, depression, aggression. And so that research has been performed, and we know statin drugs are what they call anxiogenic. And in the animal model, there's a specific guinea pig study where you just give them statins and they start to have anxiety. So that's another important point is when you are dealing in a medical model where it's considered appropriate to take patented drugs that have no history in the human body whatsoever, you know, they're xenobiotic, they don't exist in the human body and are treated like a poison, then it's likely that those are probably contributing to some of the problems. And that's really sad when it comes to the psychiatric model because, of course, the entire, you know, intervention model is based on giving these what are technically poisons to often treat symptoms of poisoning, you know.
Yes, and statins as well are a factor when it comes to hormone imbalance because, as you mentioned, we've got this cholesterol that is being suppressed, and we need that cholesterol as our raw materials for making our hormones. So we're going to have an effect on hormone production and neurotransmitter production. So it's not a good thing.
Yeah, that's a profound point because in the literature on statin-induced toxicity, we've got over 320 different adverse effects that we've now identified in the literature caused by statins. But top on the list is actually erectile dysfunction, and then low testosterone levels. So, for you know, they focus a lot on men. I'm sure if they did an analysis of women and progesterone and estrogen, they may see, find some similar effects. But it is important for people to know that, yes, when it comes to, you know, anxiety, psychiatric states, well-being, hormonal issues are really behind a lot of that. And certainly cholesterol is essential for the health of, you know, our body and mind. So very good point.
And there's, I'm sure you're aware of the research showing that cholesterol can be too low. If it's below 150 or 160, that's considered too low. And a lot of people are aiming for lower and lower numbers, and their doctors are saying, good, your cholesterol's nice and low, and it's very problematic.
Yeah, it is, and it's interesting because, you know, when people take statins, they're really just succumbing to this fear-based model of, okay, we know what kills most people in the Western world is heart disease and heart attacks specifically. So they really have bought into this completely idiotic meme, which is that you take a poison, a chemical, to suppress, you know, symptoms that may reduce your risk of, you know, disease in the future. And it's a real fear-based approach. And they put so much stock on that little chemical pill, they get a real placebo effect from it. But unfortunately, the body isn't fooled, and ultimately, there's anxiety on a real physiological level. I think the cells are kind of screaming out, stop poisoning me. And sometimes that's behind a lot of these disorders. So, yes, there's been a lot of research on the relationship between serotonin, cholesterol, and violence towards self and others. So the lower the cholesterol, the less effective serotonin is able to suppress aggression, and that leads to increased acts of violence. So, again, important to make sure you get enough cholesterol. You know, I'm a big fan of eating eggs, for example, and the yolk, of course, is rich in cholesterol. But one thing people might need to know, too, is that the best way to do it is sunny side up or to, you know, poached egg. You don't want to necessarily oxidize the cholesterol because that's truly one of the few reasons why this model predominates, the idea that cholesterol causes heart disease. Because oxidized cholesterol can actually harm the arteries, but if you're eating a lot of antioxidants, you're, you know, your body's full of all the other good things that prevent the oxidation of cholesterol, then that's going to protect you, and then therefore the number in terms of LDL isn't going to be as important. It's more about the quality of your blood lipids.
Great. And I'm glad you talked about eggs because so many people are not eating eggs. And I've had some questions about egg consumption, and we've seen so much research showing that eggs are okay. And, you know, I just read a study where they looked at egg consumption, and there was it was 1% of the study participants were having three eggs a week or something like that, and the rest were having way less than three eggs a week. So people are very afraid of eggs, and they shouldn't be. So I'm glad we brought that one up.
Yes, I agree. It's almost the perfect food in ways, but of course it all comes down to quality, and because conventional eggs are grown in such dismal and unsanitary conditions that you have issues with salmonella, and then of course you can tell by even the color of the yolk whether it's healthy and has been fed a relatively natural diet. So definitely go for the pasture raised, organic, or free range varieties whenever possible, for sure.
Great.
Yes.
Yep, and I like my eggs sunny side up too.
Good for you.
So are they, so, we talked about,
yeah.
Sorry, go ahead.
Oh, I just wanted to point out too, one interesting thing that came up in our research is there was a study published in the Journal of the Public Library of Science in 2009, and what they found was that the study participants experienced empathy when they smelled the anxiety of another participant. And this was happening below the threshold of consciousness. They basically got a chemical signal from the sweat of these anxious subjects that elicited an empathic response. And so that was an interesting example of how anxiety is not just strictly pathological. There's a reason why we get it. And sometimes we're actually in a place where we need help and we want others to, you know, kind of care about us. And so they may serve some evolutionary mechanism, so to speak, for us to experience anxiety. It's a way of others maybe activating their compassion for us. And some folks who experience chronic anxiety are very lonely. They also have depression, and they just haven't really been given that kind of attention. So it's interesting, too, if you look at the word compassion, it literally means to suffer with. You know, calm and passion to suffer. So it's an interesting thing sometimes to look at anxiety through different lenses. In some ways, everything has, you know, value, and everything has meaning.
Very interesting. That's fascinating. And it's an important thing, because when we are in trouble, we do need to be asking for help. And a lot of people don't, because there's this whole stigma around anxiety and depression and mental health issues. And it's interesting that possibly people are sensing it. And I find that so interesting. Thanks for sharing that one.
Yeah, because I think there's a tendency to pathologize in a way that isn't always accurate or necessary. On the other hand, we live at a time when we're being disrupted by so many vectors of chemicals and energies that, yes, you know, anxiety often should not be what it is, and there should be ways to correct it. So, you know, there's definitely different ways of looking at it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So we've talked,
so,
you mentioned gluten.
Mm-hmm.
Are there other
yes.
foods that can play a role that we might want to remove?
Yeah, I think that's an important point, is that really when it comes to what's the best thing for us to eat, it's such a difficult question. And to me, it's the most important question on some level when you're looking at, you know, advocating for natural medicine and taking back control of your health. You know, with the gluten issue, what's so interesting is that almost 60 years ago, gluten was linked to schizophrenia. And during World War II, in fact, when globally gluten-containing grains were rationed, they noticed, you know, globally that there were reductions in new admissions in mental hospitals for schizophrenia-related mental illnesses. So they did follow-up studies later, and they found that, yes, by removing gluten-containing grains, some schizophrenics went into remission. So, you know, more recent research actually shows that gluten has been linked to states of mania. And while there isn't a lot of research yet on anxiety reduction through gluten elimination, I believe that it will be demonstrated at some point. And really the broader issue is, what are we eating that is consistent with our evolutionary or ancestral diet? And that's what I think folks need to do. Like, we're in a really interesting time, Trudy, because you can go for $99, I think it says, get your whole genome scans, all 3 billion base pairs, you know, through 23andMe and other services. And you can see actually genetically where your body came from. You know, half of me is from Northern Europe through my mom's side, and then the other half through Asia, you know, Korea and China and Japan. So I can look back and kind of reconstruct perhaps what the nutrigenomic environment that would have been ideal for me was or is today, meaning, you know, maybe I can get away with eating some dairy products because my mother, for example, has blonde hair, blue eyes, fair skin. Her ancestors had probably 1,000 or more years of time to adjust to it. I personally don't do well with any cow's milk products or any grain, so I tried to eliminate them. But your body knows what it needs, and if it's not getting it or if it's getting foods that are inconsistent, and that affects, of course, the gut-brain axis, and that will then potentially cause anxiety. So that's why some of the really innovative folks out there, of course, you and I both know Dr. Kelly Brogan, who's in the summit as well. Most of her work is focused on diet, and that's the front door of her practice, was that they have to focus on changing more towards an ancestral diet, usually grain-free. And that clears up a lot of the issues which are normally not even treatable through conventional medication. So I find that to be so encouraging. The challenge, of course, is knowing what to eliminate. And my general recommendation, Trudy, for anyone suffering from anxiety who wants to get back in control is to eliminate all grains. And if they need something kind of as a buffer, let's say make exception for oats, because that's the one grain that actually there is some value to it, even for things like intestinal permeability. I was surprised to find this research. But if you don't want to do any grains, again, that's a better approach. You could maybe add some quinoa, amaranth, buckwheat, which are technically in a different super family of plants. So they're not part of the cereal grasses. And that makes them maybe more hospitable to our digestion. Or you focus on, you know, a root carbohydrate, things like sweet potato, if you really need that carbohydrate source, depending on your metabolism, and especially if you're a woman, because there is some gender differences here, it may be necessary to go into that realm of more vegetable type of carbohydrate. And then increase your fats, specifically saturated ones. We're talking about coconut and palm and some butter. Goat butter is another nice alternative. And you'll see that your whole metabolism shifts and gets less inclined to slip into the fight or flight, because what overlaps with, you know, sort of the physiology of anxiety and fear, you know, we have the elevated cortisol and blood sugar and adrenaline, is that your body will also, when it's dealing with sort of the neuroendocrine roller coaster and brain consumption and carbohydrates and sugar, will constantly go into this sort of emergency state. It'll secrete adrenaline and cortisol just to get your blood sugar up after a big insulin spike when your, you know, blood levels are dropped and your brain is freaking out, hasn't had any sugar for a few minutes. So sometimes the root problems can be addressed simply by going back to a more ancestral diet, getting out all those grains and simple carbohydrates, increasing the fats, and, of course, saturating your body with not vitamins, but the food form of the nutrients and vitamins and minerals, which have not just the actual elements and molecules and compounds, but have the information needed to deliver it to the right body, or at least enable the body to accept it in a way that is, you know, based on millions of years of adaptation and coevolution.
I love that. Saturate the body with the food form of the vitamins and minerals. That's beautiful. And I love this focus on food. We've got to go back to food. Food is our foundation.
Yes.
And I love the work of Kelly Brogan. I'm so pleased that she's going to be on the summit again. And I'm so glad that you emphasize this, because just going back to how we were supposed to eat and going back to our heritage is such an important topic. There's all these other things that we can look at. But if we just go back to basics, that is going to make such a big difference and give us such a good foundation.
Absolutely. Another thing, too, people can really start incorporating is therapeutic interventions that don't have anything to do with what you put in your mouth. Because that's one of the things we realized when we did this project of, like, kind of looking at all the anxiety research on Medline, is that a good portion of it is on things like yoga. And there was actually just recently a study that found that it was highly effective at reducing anxiety. And of course, anyone who's experienced yoga knows that this is just basic common sense, because the whole practice is to kind of get your body to go into more deeper awareness and relaxation and integration of the mind and the body. But thankfully now it's not just, you know, woo. You have all these really, you know, high impact journals confirming that, yes, yoga is excellent. Now, we've actually identified 21 therapeutic actions on our anxiety disorders page that show benefit. That includes emotional freedom technique, which is something that Dr. McCullough, for example, is a big advocate of. It's involving tapping your meridians. It's almost like acupuncture, but you're not using needles. It's something you can self-administer at any point. Other related therapies like shiatsu I find extremely beneficial. I get a little anxiety when I go to the dentist for, I've had some oral surgery, and they put in the norepinephrine, which is extremely anxiogenic, into the anesthesia so they can constrict the blood vessels and localize that anesthesia. And I often ask them to take it out because when they shoot it in, if they don't aspirate correctly, it can go right into your blood and you get this massive anxiety. So what I do is I press that little meaty spot between my thumb and my forefinger there, and that is a shiatsu point for reduction of anxiety. And I've found that to be extremely effective, something as simple as just pressing that one shiatsu point. Then you have aromatherapy massage. Of course, anyone receiving a good massage knows that that can be very anxiolytic, as well as art therapy, color therapy, craniosacral therapy, dancing. We already talked about empathy. That has an anxiety-reducing effect. And then we have, homeopathic treatments, music, guided imagery. So the beauty of it is there are many things that we all know in our lifestyle. If we made time, if we got more involved in that aspect of our life, then we would be able to find ways to, you know, reduce anxiety without medication or even natural supplements.
Excellent. I love it. So I'd just like some clarification on the shiatsu spot for the anxiety. And then do you do that just before you go into the dentist, or you're doing it while you're at the dentist?
You can do it before, and you can also do it while, because it's sometimes just really helpful. You know, if you're pressing in that spot while it's happening, it kind of gives you a sense of control as well. And if you Google, you know, shiatsu, anxiety points, you can do this for a lot of conditions. And if you headache, you'll find great descriptions, and you can give it a try. And often I've found it to be very effective. Now, even if it's placebo, if it works, it works. And that's kind of the beauty of placebo effect.
Great, great. And I love that you mentioned all these others as well. The dancing, I think, is great, and that could fit under exercise too. I'm always saying find something that you like to do, and if you don't like to go to the gym, find something else, and maybe dancing or dancing is what's going to do it for you. And it's good to see that there's research on that. And the music, I think, is wonderful. I've been looking into that area quite a bit, which is quite interesting because I'm not very musically oriented, but I enjoy hearing music, and I find it very relaxing. And so I'm glad we mentioned that one as well.
Definitely. Yeah, I think it's important. You know, it's so interesting with anxiety. It's such a great topic. And I know your last summit was so well, you know, visited and received, because when we're dealing with disease and you go to the root meaning of the word, obviously, it's like basically saying anxiety, you know, dis-ease. And anxiety is a dis-ease or unease. So, you know, one of the most important things, I think, in the past 20, 30 years is this notion that you can't separate out, you know, the body as a sort of piece of meat, you know, this machine, from the mind and the soul. And that's where this connection is so important, is for folks to realize that, you know, we are, you know, souls, and we have bodies. You know, we're not just bodies with this mind that is like an excreta of the brain, like, you know, urine is to the kidney. That's what people think, you know, that we're just this machine, and we have neurotransmitters, chemicals in our brain, and that makes us think. It's quite the opposite. And this isn't a New Age concept. I mean, we ultimately know that just by our attitude, you know, our perspective, you know, our expectations, we can profoundly affect our physiology. There was actually a very interesting study that was published in Current Opinion in Anesthesiology in 2007. What they found was that the expectations people have for pain actually translated directly into whether they experience this cholecystokinin release, which turns into pain. So in other words, if you expect something to be a bad experience and causing pain, that nocebo or negative placebo effect actually causes hyperalgesia, or enhances the pain, not just subjectively, but objectively. They can measure increased markers for pain. And so people really should start looking at this closely, because when it comes to things like we had talked about cancer earlier, this massive undertaking based on, it was almost a million Swedes found, this was published in the New England Journal of Medicine just a few years ago, that when someone was diagnosed with cancer, if they had a positive cancer diagnosis, meaning you have cancer, the cancer of the brain, they were more likely to die from a heart attack in the first week, up to 29 times more likely to die of a heart attack than those who had received a negative diagnosis. And this is important, of course, because we talked about how so many diagnoses today, for example, breast cancer, about 1.3 million women in the past 30 years were diagnosed for DCIS, for breast cancer, and treated for it, mastectomy, lumpectomy, et cetera, who never had it, meaning that that lesion was not going to progress to cause symptoms and certainly wasn't going to take their lives. So all these women, okay, who had been given this nocebic response, not only were they cut into and medicated and had to deal with all that, but you imagine their spirit and like their constant fear and anxiety over thinking that they have cancer that could return. And so that's what I'm saying is that really the modern environment in medicine is sort of remembering that the physician and the patient have profound healing power, or quite the opposite, depending on their belief and their faith in whether their body can heal. So my thing is that first, if anyone has anxiety out there, and anyone on medication should acknowledge that they have the ability to do this naturally, and their body naturally will come into balance. The disease is not our, you know, birthright. It's quite the opposite. Remove the interference, you know, address whatever chemical injuries you've experienced, including medication injuries, and do it, of course, under the guidance of someone with, you know, professional experience who can help, because coming off some of these anti-anxiety medications can cause extremely potent states of anxiety and even, you know, withdrawals like alcohol withdrawal syndrome. So you got to be careful, but know that you have a birthright to be whole, healthy, and spiritually balanced, and that's really what it takes, is just knowing that you deserve it and that your body and your mind and your soul will attain it if you, you know, persist.
Beautiful. Yes, we do have this birthright and we do deserve it, and we've got to keep looking until we find the answer. And sometimes it might take a little bit longer, but knowing mm-hmm. that this information is out there and that it's, you deserve to find it, and getting to the root cause of it, getting back to basics, eating this real food, and then doing all these other things that may work, and keeping in mind that everyone's different. You know, as I said, someone may find that dancing is helpful. Someone may find art therapy is very helpful. Someone mm-hmm. may find the music is helpful. So finding what works for you. And just going back to the whole music comment is mm-hmm. that I, as I said, I'm totally music challenged. I can't sing a tune. And I heard this amazing singer at an event I went to and just loved her music. It just was so inspiring and so calming for me. And when I was planning this summit, I approached her and said, I would like a song. I want a song that I can share with people on the summit. And I've now a songwriter. I've worked with her, and we've created this song that we're going to share with everyone
really?
On the summit. And
wow.
it's just so amazing. Every time I hear it, I just get goosebumps, and I'm just hoping it's going to inspire
wow.
people to do what you're saying here, is looking for answers. You've got this birthright to be, mm-hmm. to feel on top of the world, to feel absolutely great all the time. And, mm-hmm. yeah, so, mm-hmm. you know, that would could be one way that might help someone who's feeling anxious and feeling hopeless, because there is an answer out there.
Yeah, it's beautiful. You know, I think it's confusing to people, because it's true. You know, you can take a real bottom-up approach, and you can affect your mood and your mind, you know, through changing your diet, removing a chemical, addressing maybe an infection you didn't know you had. But you can also do it from the top down. And that's where some people think, oh, that's not evidence-based. And, you know, again, that's like New Age. But it's really not, is that we have a choice. And there are different ways to approach things. It's not, neither one is, you know, necessarily better than the other. But we have a lot of choices. And certainly, anxiety is not fun. We all have experienced it, and just know that there's simple ways to address it. One of them, too, I really wanted to mention, just out of personal experience, mm-hmm. is magnesium, because it's able to buffer sort of the catecholamine response. So when you get those fight or flight hormones released, like adrenaline, you know, your body is able to deal much better with magnesium there to buffer things. So it's a good muscle relaxant, you know, and has just such a great role to play, and the Western diet is so terribly deficient in it. And there's a lot of people dealing with malabsorption. If you're on a proton pump inhibitor, for example, hypomagnesia is almost guaranteed. In fact, some people have died from it. So, you know, again, we're also a calcium-heavy culture, and that also is sort of like a seesaw effect. The more calcium we think we're taking for our bones, even though it might be going into our soft tissue, the more magnesium you need to balance it out. So again, there's so many things we can do just nutritionally, even just as a real safe supplement intervention. Just don't give up, and you keep trying to do a natural approach whenever possible, because it's really the only long-term solution that will be available.
Yep, definitely. This has been fantastic. Any other recommendations you can make, or should we wrap it up?
Well, I would say the most important thing, again, is to just start focusing on your diet. You know, if you're already on a medication, for example, it's really important that you exercise great care. And again, I would hope you find a good holistic psychiatrist out there. There aren't many who can help if you are looking to taper off, but acknowledge the danger of doing that on your own. And the best way to prepare for that process, of course, is to start focusing on a diet that really supports your sort of genetic background, and certainly all humans need certain fundamental substances. You know, vitamin D, for example, has profound antidepressant effects. If you're dealing with mild scurvy, just adding in a good dose of vitamin C can really help the adrenal glands and might help buffer anxiety as well. So just, again, focus on food as your medicine, and know there is good research out there to support not having to go on a medication if you're not on one already. And for those who are on them, you know, you can bring this research, go to GreenMedInfo, it's open access, send it to them and say, hey, doc, I'd love to consider going on a natural alternative. And this will help move the paradigm forward. So it's not us versus them. It's us working together. And hopefully everyone, you know, will be in a better state for it.
Great, yes. And having that research, I think, is very beneficial when you are talking to your doctor. And then I wanted to just reiterate what you said about getting off the some of the medications, certainly the benzodiazepines, really. You don't want to stop suddenly, and you want to work with someone and consider, you know, very, very slow taper. I actually have interviewed Dr. Jonathan Prowski, a Canadian naturopathic physician who's talking specifically on techniques and approaches to try and mitigate some of the effects of benzodiazepine withdrawal. So it's a big topic, and so many people are prescribed benzodiazepine. So just be aware that you gather this information, take it in, and then work with someone who can help you get off the benzodiazepines if that's what you are planning to do. So I'm glad you emphasize that, because I think it's important.
Definitely. Yeah.
Great. Well, this has been really fantastic, Saya. You've got a great gift that you're offering folks, and it's an e-course called The Wisdom of Food, which is very appropriate, seeing we emphasize food in this interview as well. So thank you for offering that, and we'll make sure that the link to that is available on the replay page and on the blog that goes with this. Anything you want to say about that e-course?
Oh, no, just, enjoy. I'd love to give that away. It's just my sort of culmination of many years of meditation and reflection on what food really is. And it's really profound in the sense of food is information and as much as, you know, matter and energy. And once we realize that, I think they'll realize that it is truly the future of medicine, because what we do or do not eat is going to be the most important thing to do for taking back control of our health.
Absolutely. And then you're very generously offering two free professional memberships at GreenMedInfo, and we'll do a drawing. So thank you for offering that. And do you want to just tell us what this professional membership means, just so folks know what they could be winning?
Oh, yeah. Well, actually, we just upgraded it so that we have about $11,000. They're all research documents. Like, for example, Turmeric has 1,500 citations that are organized on a PDF that they can send and show to someone who says, hey, turmeric doesn't have any research behind it. Well, here's 650 diseases that's been shown to be helpful for. And so we actually have over 5,000 of those PDFs. And that's only one of 11 features that we offer the professional members. So, you know, we feel it's, you know, just a really powerful way to move the paradigm forward, you know, optimize people's practice and advocacy, and giving them the tools that they need, you know, to really promote awareness that, yeah, there's plenty of evidence to support, you know, ancient traditional healing practices.
Wonderful. Well, thanks for your generous offer. That's wonderful. I know it's going to be very handy. And if you definitely, if you're interested in the research or if you want to gather research to take to your health practitioner, this would be a great resource for you. So thanks for sharing that. I'd like to just end and say, any final words of wisdom?
Oh, well, just to, again, acknowledge that, you know, we are born with everything we need to be healthy and whole. And, you know, again, thank you, Trudy, for this summit because, it, you know, people are dealing with this constantly. Anxiety is just built into, you know, our time and age. So we need solutions. And thank you for, you know, having this summit.
You are welcome. Well, thank you very much for participating. And thank you for the great work that you do, sharing all the great research and sharing all these great articles and sharing the message.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot for being with us today.
All right. Thanks so much.
Thank you. And thanks, everyone, for joining us for another great interview on the Anxiety Summit. Do tune in for another one. This is Trudy Scott signing off.